This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyus Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
For the next 6 months alone, the World Food Program requires $4.5 billion, and the consequences of inaction and these funding shortfalls will be measured in lost lives.
That's World Food Program spokesman Thompson Piri on the need for billions of dollars to ease the threat of famine for more than 34 million people in several African countries. Details coming up. Also, South Africa's president tightens the country's COVID restrictions. And Britain's ambassador to the UN says Eritrean forces need to leave Ethiopia. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The World Food Program reports swift action and billions of dollars in relief funding are urgently needed to bring more than 34 million people in several African countries and Yemen back from the brink of famine. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Last weekend, G7 leaders expressed concern about the humanitarian crisis facing millions of people who are teetering on the edge of famine. They pledged $7 billion to prevent the catastrophic possibility of hundreds of thousands of people starving to death. The World Food Program welcomes the G7 leaders' commitment to provide life-saving humanitarian aid. However, WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says this pledge of money and of preventive action comes with a caveat.
Our ability to save lives depends on unimpeded humanitarian access. And having these funding commitments come from G7, which, if fulfilled, we will be able to expand and reach those who are most in need.
Past appeals for famine prevention relief have fallen short of the mark. In March, WFP and the Food and Agriculture Organization called for $5.5 billion to scale up operations and avert widespread famine. Because that goal was not reached, Feary says WFP has been forced to cut rations for millions of people. In some cases, he says, this has meant taking food from the hungry to give to the starving.
We have cases where we need to prevent famine from taking a grip in countries such as Yemen, South Sudan, Burkina Faso, Madagascar, and most recently the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Now, for the next 6 months alone, the World Food Program requires $4.5 billion, and the consequences of inaction and these funding shortfalls will be measured in lost lives.
Lack of access to people in desperate need of humanitarian assistance is also hampering life-saving relief efforts. For example, in northern Ethiopia's embattled Tigray province, WFP officials say an estimated 350,000 people face catastrophic levels of hunger. WFP says it is unable to alleviate their suffering because armed groups are still blocking humanitarian assistance to the region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations humanitarian chief is warning that the 1984 famine, which killed more than 1 million Ethiopians, could occur again if aid access to the Tigray region is not quickly scaled up and properly funded. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Brashear reports that aid chief Mark Lowcock told a private meeting of the UN Security Council yesterday that there is a famine now in parts of Tigray. In recent remarks, VOA has seen he warned the situation is likely to get worse, not only in Tigray, but also in the Afar and Amhara regions. UN agencies have reported about 5.5 million people in Tigray, Afar and Amhara regions face crisis levels of food insecurity. Aid access to hard-to-reach areas has been a problem since the conflict began. In November, federal forces started what the national government calls a law enforcement action responding to attacks by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF. Since then, thousands of people have died in the violence and tens of thousands have been displaced. After the meeting, Ethiopia's UN ambassador, Taye Askaselase Amdi, told reporters the situation did not warrant Security Council attention. He added that his government vehemently disagreed with the humanitarian assessment and said it should not be used to pressure Ethiopia's government.
They utilized, you know, a very botched approach when it comes in collecting data, because the Ethiopian government didn't agree with that. It was not done in a transparent and inclusive way. The methodology that has been deployed to collect data was completely wrong, because they used a couple of cell phones in rural Ethiopia to collect the data. So there was a difference on those points. But even having said that, using humanitarian issues, particularly famine, and starvation in order to exert undue pressure on Ethiopia is completely unacceptable.
He also said that given Ethiopia's history of famine, his government would never use hunger as a weapon of war. The British ambassador, Barbara Woodward, said her government is confident in the data that was presented and said Security Council members should call for a ceasefire.
Without a ceasefire, this could become a man-made famine. It's not a drought or locusts that are causing this hunger, but the decisions of those in power. That means those in power could also end the suffering. We were told in March that Eritrean forces would be withdrawing. It's now June. There can be no further delay. Farmers have been unable to plant next year's crops due to the violence. The window for them to do so is about to close. And while the violence continues, it is not only condemning the people of Tigray to desperate hunger this year, but next year too. Millions of people's lives hang in the balance. The solution is clear: a ceasefire, humanitarian access, and political dialogue.
Ethiopian Ambassador Taye said humanitarian access is unfettered, but then acknowledged some roadblocks.
So we have a very strong commitment that access is guaranteed by all means. But we see, as I said earlier, some challenges here and there. So for the good of the humanitarian workers, we don't want them to be in harm's way. It could be stopped for a couple of hours, for a day, and then, of course, it proceeds. So in areas where there are some pockets of resistance, indeed, there are some limitations. But our determination and commitment is to reach out to the needy people.
Britain's Ambassador Woodward also said Eritrean forces need to leave Ethiopia, noting that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government said in March they would leave, and that still has not happened. The Ethiopian envoy said the delay was due to some technical and procedural issues and that his government expects them to leave soon. Algeria's ruling party, the National Liberation Front, FLN, has won parliamentary elections with a significantly reduced number of seats and the country's lowest turnout. Out of the 24 million eligible voters, only 5.6 million lodged the ballot in last Saturday's poll. The vote was boycotted by the long-running Hirak movement, followed by a string of arrests of opposition figures, with police deployed heavily in the capital Algiers to prevent any attempt to hold the rallies. According to the French news agency AFP, out of the 407 seats, the ruling party won only 105. It lost 50 seats and will control just a quarter of the new assembly. Independence garnered 78 seats and the country's moderate Islamist party, 64. French President Emmanuel Macron says he has assurances that Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants foreign mercenaries to leave Libya as soon as possible. Meanwhile, Russian President's assistant Yuri Ushakov says Russian President Vladimir Putin will meet with his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden today to discuss Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, and several other issues. Wolfgang Porchtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi whether Biden could secure a Russian pool out of Libya.
The Russian armed personnel in Libya are mercenaries from the private military company Wagner. I'm sure that Putin has a strong influence on the company, but I'm also sure that he can't give them something like an order to leave Libya. He most likely does not pay them there, so they would not probably obey to his orders. And Wagner is engaged in about 20 countries, probably even more than 20. And while they are certainly not working against Russian interests, not all their engagements can be seen in direct connection or cooperation with Russian foreign policy. Furthermore, I don't see any real incentives for Putin to force Wagner out of Libya, especially as he needs the company in other countries and as they are supporting Russian interests in Libya. So altogether, I would say the Russian mercenaries will stay at least as long as they are paid for it. And this means as long as Turkish troops are in Libya, as they are outbalancing them.
French President Emmanuel Macron said he had received assurances from Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan that he wanted foreign mercenaries to leave Libyan territory as soon as possible. What's your take on that?
It could well be that Erdogan wants to use his Syrian mercenaries paid for by Turkey as a bargain chip to get the Russians and the other mercenaries on the side of the LNA out of Libya. But I doubt that the Turkish president was referring to his own troops, especially not after last week's visit of Foreign Minister Cavusoglu and Defense Minister Hulusi Akar in Tripoli, where both ruled out the withdrawal of Turkish troops from Libya. One also needs to keep in mind that Libyan Foreign Minister Naila Al-Mangoush ran recently into serious troubles because she dared to talk about a withdrawal of the Turks. She got blamed for by the Misrata, by the Islamists, and by the Turks that she is supporting Haftar. In the East, on the other side, many consider the Turks as neo-colonizers and as supporters of the arch enemies of the Islamists. So altogether, Libya is deeply split in this question. This is a very polarizing topic. Last Monday, there was even a fist fighting between representatives in the Libyan parliament about this. However, on the other side, the Turkish presence in Libya is also quite costly for the ground down Turkish economy. And maybe even more important, Egypt made the Turkish withdrawal one of the preconditions for a normalization of relations between Cairo and Ankara. And this is much sought for by Erdogan. Nevertheless, I would rule out that Erdogan withdraws his troops from Libya, at least as long as he sees a military option to decide the conflict. In other words, as long as he sees the opportunity to take the oil crescent and to defeat Haftar's Libyan National Army decisively.
Would a unified stand by Western countries in the upcoming Berlin II conference result in a withdrawal of mercenaries and foreign forces from Libya?
Realistically seen, I don't believe so. The willingness of the Western countries to seriously pressure Turkey and those who are financing Wagner, including probably still the United Arab Emirates, is simply not there. And in Libya, there is a huge distrust between the two conflict parties, so I don't see any of them to renounce their foreign support unilaterally. But one thing is for sure, as long as those foreign forces and mercenaries remain in Libya without having the ceasefire consolidated, there is still the risk, actually I would say an increasing risk of a major escalation. So the stabilization of the ceasefire by an international monitoring mission is still the best assurance to prevent an escalation from happening and to make Turks and Russians and all the other mercenaries redundant. So consolidating the ceasefire should be the main, and I would see the only one realistic objective of the Berlin conference.
That was Wolfgang Porchtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has tightened the country's COVID-19 restrictions another notch, exactly 2 weeks after taking action against the third wave of the coronavirus. Ramaphosa cited rapidly increasing infections, deaths, and hospitalization. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In his address to the nation last night, Ramaphosa said daily infections have doubled from 3,700 to 7,500. COVID-related hospitalizations have moved up by 56%, with deaths increasing by 48%. Four of the country's nine provinces are officially in the third wave, prompting Ramaphosa to introduce tougher restrictions that raise concerns about the impact of health care and the economy.
We need to enforce compliance more rigorously, and we need to take firmer action against those who do not adhere to the regulations that save our lives.
Curfew hours now run from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. Non-essential establishments like restaurants, bars and fitness centers must close by 9 p.m. so employees and patrons can go home before curfew starts. All gatherings are now limited to a maximum of 50 people indoors and 100 people outdoors. This includes religious services, political events, social gatherings, as well as restaurants, bars, taverns, and similar places. Alcohol sales from retail outlets for off-site consumption will only be permitted between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday to Thursday. Those choosing to consume alcohol on site in licensed outlets can only do so till 9 p.m. Wendy Alberts is the CEO of the Restaurant Association of South Africa.
It has a massive impact on us. Our dinner time trade is 70% of our overall turnover. And at this point in time, again, we are going to be trading at restricted turnovers with 100% capacity to paying our operational costs.
But Karen Beck, a public health expert, says it's either act now or never.
Yeah, it's very concerning. Our test positivity rate hasn't actually been this high for a very long time. Everything is indicating it's going up, not just cases, but also hospitalizations, oxygen use, and deaths as well.
So far, 480,000 health workers have been vaccinated with the once-off Johnson & Johnson vaccine in South Africa, while 1.5 million additional people have had their first dose of the Pfizer vaccine. Over 1.7 people have been infected up to date, while the death toll exceeds 58,000. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Africa's intensive care units are full of patients battling to survive COVID-19. A third wave of the pandemic, driven by a highly infectious variant, has sent deaths spiking, especially in Gauteng province, home of the country's most populous city, Johannesburg. Emergency service personnel and hospitals say they are overwhelmed, while scientists are concerned that the third wave is proving to be much worse than the previous COVID-19 outbreaks. Darren Taylor has more.
The surge in coronavirus casualties has forced hospitals to suspend non-life-threatening surgery and admissions as they desperately try to reserve a limited number of beds for COVID-19 patients. Chief Director of Gauteng Health Services, Macy Relutla, insists, though, that everything's under control, despite a 100% increase in hospitalizations over the past few weeks.
We have almost three times the number of patients that we had a month ago. And with that, we have made available COVID beds, and we continue to reallocate the beds as the need arises.
But speaking on condition of anonymity, some of Lerutla's doctors told VOA, you can't reallocate what doesn't exist. The situation's made more dire by the closure of one of Gauteng's major hospitals, Charlotte Maxeke, in Johannesburg, due to a recent fire.
The closure of Charlotte Maxeke, it has knocked out 300 to 400 COVID beds from the health system in Gauteng, and that has put the entire system under pressure.
Dr. Farid Abdullah is a director at the South African Medical Research Council. He says the only way to save lives now is to somehow find extra beds at hospitals across the province.
For that, we need two things, really. One is additional nurses so that more beds can be opened up. But, you know, you need a good, well-organized machinery with ambulance and emergency medical services so that people can be moved around to where there are available beds. Those people who would have been going to Charlotte Maclaire will now have to go to other hospitals.
But, says Abdullah, this isn't happening and lives are being lost because of grave shortages of nurses, ambulances, medics and life-saving equipment.
An ambulance gets called to a home. EMS personnel are expected to make a very difficult assessment if the patient needs the hospital bed or not, and then to know where to go, and they have a patient in the ambulance and no bed to take them to, trying to find a bed in any hospital. It's an extremely difficult situation. As you know,
he's asking the government to provide emergency funding to buy, equip and staff ambulance services as soon as possible. But the state says its focus is on ensuring a speedy rollout of vaccines as it tries to make sure people don't need ambulances or hospital beds. Abdullah says South African EMS personnel are doing amazing work with very limited resources.
Our emergency medical services are able to transport patients with a transport ventilator. You know, you can imagine how difficult that is to do. You have to be completely covered in PPE because the patient is COVID positive, but you also have to manage a very sick patient who's in respiratory distress on a ventilator, moving them from one hospital to another. So we have the capacity, we have the expertise, but we need more organization, we need more resources, we need more personnel to do this now.
An association of doctors, the Progressive Health Forum, says the third wave is going to be deadlier than previous waves, mainly because South Africans aren't sufficiently vaccinated. The government acknowledges only about 1% of targeted immunizations have happened, but says its vaccine program will go faster in the next few weeks. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Efforts to rein in Zimbabwe's rise in COVID-19 cases could be hampered by porous borders and the spread of health certificates that allow communities to continue traveling to and from neighboring South Africa despite tightened lockdown regulations. Adigando gives us more on the story.
Authorities at the Beitbridge crossing placed 49 returnees into quarantine after a woman who is reported to have traveled from India via South Africa was seized by the rapid response team on a bus owned by a Zimbabwean company. Zimbabwe's government this past week introduced new COVID-19 regulations as cases spike, according to Health and Childcare Minister Constantine Chiwenga. Zimbabwe has had 596 new cases and 26 deaths in the past week, compared with 132 cases and 6 deaths in the same period last year. Meanwhile, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa last night announced measures to curb the spread of the pandemic, with the number of daily infections doubling from 2 weeks ago. He blamed the third wave on complacency. The statistics represent a worrying trend for Zimbabwe, given that the two countries share borders, albeit a porous one, with commuters crossing legally and illegally. Analysts also say the proliferation of fake COVID-19 certificates exacerbates efforts to halt the spread. Mabuto Mabena of the Zimbabwe South Africa Association, an organization representing Zimbabwean immigrants in South Africa, says he isn't surprised by the recent interception of the commuter bus.
What we've observed was that we realized that some bus companies will allow or will sell fake COVID certificate at the bus park station or in their buses, so people would not go for testing, and we condemn that. What we know is that buses do go to Zimbabwe. Buses still travel across the border.
Sociopolitical analyst Efinwe says millions of people cross the border, many without legal documents, so the two countries pose risks to each other in terms of spreading COVID-19.
It is important that as many people as possible within South Africa, in Zimbabwe, regardless of their status, whether they are lawful residents there or not, they have access to vaccination and they do get their certificates so that they use them. If that is not the case, people then are always going to use the alternative means, that is fake certificates.
There's general consensus that more needs to be done to curb fake certificates and make the vaccines more easily available in both Zimbabwe and South Africa. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.